Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Basser Hour. The Basser Hour is an in-depth look at things affecting today's veteran. The Basser Hour is sponsored by www.hadit.com. If you need help with the VA, log on to hadit.com. Now, here's your host, Jay Basser.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Basser Hour. This is Jay, along with my co-host, Mr. Gerald Cook. It's the 30th day of July, 2018. We've been a bit under the weather here. It's been raining for the last couple of hours, pretty hard, hot and heavy, both here and Gerald's location in the great state of Missouri. And we have a special treat today. We have Dr. Bash. He's going to be on here in a minute. He's taking care of tying some loose ends, but he's going to come in and talk about his Bash Bulletin. And this bulletin basically is going to cover the importance of getting an independent medical opinion when you have your VA claim. So he'll tell us all about that good information, and we'll discuss spinal cord injuries in the next part of the show. So just bear with us, and Dr. Bash will be here in just a couple of minutes. Gerald, how you doing today, buddy?
Well, I'm doing all right, John. Staying out of the weather there. Went to the doctor this morning and just made it home here, and it started raining, so I've stayed indoors ever since. Don't want to get wet.
That's you probably hear the background. We got that. I think Dr. Bash has finally made it back. Are you with us, Dr. Bash?
Yeah, I'm back.
Hi, okay. We've already started the discussion topic. We're going to talk about starting off with the Bash Bulletin, and the one that deals with the importance of getting the independent medical opinions or examinations when dealing with VA claims.
Right. For the examination? Yeah.
Yeah.
Specific question?
Yeah. Basically, just kind of an over, just based on your bulletin itself, you know, how you wrote it up, you know, just basically reports getting, evaluation and what to look for and things like that, and what type of evaluation a person needs, and, you know, what type of doctors and things like that. Just general information.
Yeah. Yeah. Those CMP examinations or DBQs, are important because it's the way the VA provides nexus. The DDQ and the exam is basically the rating percent, and the nexus is the linkage. So the VA can hurt you on both sides of that. They can downplay the exam, and they can downplay the nexus. So the best idea is to be prepared when you go in. And one way to be prepared is to make sure you get as much testing as you can. So, for example, maybe you have a spine injury, and it's gotten worse over the years, and you get a repeat X-ray or MRI scan that shows that it got worse, then that's good evidence that the VA has to think about instead of just relying on a physical exam that might be a little bit better, depends on the day and stuff like that. So that helps. That applies for kidney disease and applies for hearing tests and applies for everything. Try and get testing to document what's going on. And then I always talk about trying to find out who the examiner is. Sometimes they have nurse practitioners and PAs, and those guys oftentimes don't have the depth of knowledge. I had a patient last week that had all kinds of problems. Had like some weight loss, had some arrhythmias, and then lo and behold, the lady had a bunch of hair loss and cervix. And so then, later on, she ended up with thyroid disease. And you put that all together, she had thyroid disease back in cervix, and that was all part of that hair loss problem she had. And as nurse practitioners and PAs just aren't able to deal with all those different complicated aspects of the medical part, and so they just take a little piece of it. The VA says, look at the person's, look at their spine, or just look at their hair loss or something. It's kind of like the old story with the elephant. Somebody feels the trunk, and somebody feels the tail, and somebody feels the side of the elephant, and they don't realize it's an elephant until they put it all together. So
that's good.
Also, it's a little puzzle. That's why I like medicine diagnosis. It's a puzzle. And so then, you got to make sure you have good lay letters. Get those done first. I always recommend getting an IME, a nexus letter. Get yourself a nexus letter before you go to the exam. at the exam, they won't let you enter new evidence. You want to make sure you get that stuff uploaded a few days before so that that way the examiner's got to read it and has a chance to look at it. And if they don't look at it or integrate it, then that's an automatic kind of appealable thing because it's, you know, it's an error not considering all the evidence.
Let me reiterate that.
I always tell patients,
Dr. Bass mentioned the term IME, folks. That's a very important term. I mean, you've got an IMO, which is a medical opinion, but an IME is a independent medical examination, and that's kind of a little bit higher level. The VA takes a little more more weight to that examination versus an opinion. So that's a good point, Dr. Bash.
Yeah, the IME is a big deal. So like, I had a guy the other day that had like 5 issues, and the VA only did 1 IME on that person, you know, DBQ. So I wrote my DBQs, and sometimes they take them, sometimes they don't take them, but when I do a DBQ, that forces the VA to do some DBQs on their side, so they had to go back and examine them for the 5, you know, 4 or 5 leftover issues. And then we can compare notes and stuff like that. So, yeah, those IMEs are important. And, you know, the X-ray is kind of an IME, and the lab tests are kind of an IME because all those data points, you know, match up to help the claim get rated. Yeah. Yeah, also, I tell patients also think about the worst-case scenario, which is really the idea of a flare-up. The VA has a lot of rules about flare-up, and so the examiner is supposed to talk to you about flare-ups. And so a lot of patients are stoic, they don't want to talk about it, or they take pain meds before. I tell them, don't take your pain meds. Also, make sure you talk about the worst-case day with the flare-ups so that the examiner has a chance to do it. And, sometimes the examiners will give you leading questions, like, you feel great today, or you feel normal, right? The patient says, yeah, I feel great, or whatever, and so he just writes down normal, when really the patient might have chronic pain. So that's important. Also, I tell them, make sure for the exam they take their crutches, their wheelchair, their cane, or their braces, any of that stuff, because oftentimes the VA examiner might spend 10 or 15 minutes, and if there's no crutch, cane, or wheelchair, he's not going to mark any of that stuff down. So
yeah,
make sure you use all those devices.
I know we had a guy here that was somewhere in one of the VA systems, was going in for a C&P exam. He got his cane out of his car and struggled into the VA and went through his exam. He come back out in the parking garage and popped his trunk and put the cane in there and got his car and walked off like, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. They used that against him. They had him on video.
Yep. I always tell I always tell the patients that the exam starts in the car and into the car, you know, because I've had examiners look at people through windows and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's important. Right. You know, I also talk about this idea of a walker. Like, I ask patients, he's a walker. I said, no, he's a walker. And I said, if you go to Walmart, do you lean on the shopping cart? He said, I can't go anywhere without the shopping cart. So that shopping cart is really a wheeled walker. So I make sure the patients can describe things in the way that the examiner can understand, you know.
Yeah, that's true. And my wife, every time she goes into the store like that, she grabs onto a cart and uses it.
Yeah, of course.
I have to too. It depends. Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah,
it's a big deal.
The patients don't really think about that as a walker, so that's important. That's one of the big questions. On most of the orthopedic DVQs talk about: do you use a walker, cane, crutches, wheelchair? You know.
What is your opinion on the DVQs now? Do you like the format, or do you think it could be improved?
Well, like I always talk about the fact that, you know, they could always be improved, but, you know, I've got them memorized now, so I don't worry about the format so much anymore, but, you know, I can just go through them. But, you know, there's 65,000 codes, and there's only 70 DBQs or so, so they're kind of a broad brush. There's a lot of stuff in each DBQ that doesn't apply to the specific radio. Like, I'll leave things blank, and patients go, hey, man, some of these things are blank, and so a lot of the stuff doesn't even apply because it's just a shotgun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the, like, say, for the knee, a lot of that radio is based on the range of motion and stability, and there's 8 pages of questions, and it doesn't really match up with the reading schedule, you know, so. And the confusion, like a lot of VA doctors, there's places on the spine thing where it asks all this question about spine disease, and towards the end it asks a question about, well, this patient has intervertebral disc disease, and a lot of the VA doctors will check that as no when a patient has it. So the DBQs are confusing to the medical logic because our logic, the way we are taught to do exams and evaluations, is a different order and a different logic pathway. So the DVQs are kind of confusing to the physician, you know, until you get them memorized because they're kind of backwards in a way. You know, they're more of a legal document than they are a medical document, so it's kind of hard to mesh it sometimes.
Well, wouldn't a DVQ be a better doctor if it had a place for you to write an opinion?
Yeah, I agree with that. You're exactly right. So the DVQ, usually question 2, 3, 4, somewhere there, and ask a question about what the history is, and they give you like a quarter of an inch or something. Usually what I do there is I tell the patient to attach a lay letter and let them write, you know, as much as they want. I have some lay letter samples that talks about, you know, where it happened and what happened in service, what happened now. So there's no space for it. And the same thing for the doctor. Towards the end of the DVQ, many of those DVQs only have like half an inch or an inch space to try and write something. So like if I do my Nexus letter, you know, my Nexus letter might be 1, 2, 3, 4 pages for each issue. Depends on how big it is. I might have integrated the lay letters. I might have integrated some literature. I might have brought in some imaging tests, you know. And so I put in rationale, and I might critique the other doctor's opinion. So all that stuff, there's no way I can put that at half an inch on the page. And if I typed it really small, so, you know, it's almost a setup. It's almost a setup for failure because it doesn't give the doctor any chance to explain himself. So then if you fill the DVQ out and send it in, then the VA says no rationale, and they deny it because there's no rationale. So,
when the CMP examiner, he writes or they write a opinion, because usually they say, you know, it'd be a figment of my imagination or something.
Speculation.
Well, you're right
about that, because the VA has their own special website for DBQs. You might have seen some of these DBQ forms. Look, the ones the VA doctors use look a lot different than the ones that they issue on their website, right?
Yes.
I had one for heart disease here back in the latter part of last year, and they sent me a DVQ. I filed for AFib and arrhythmias, and they sent me a DVQ for hypertension. So I had to get the right one printed off, take it and get it filled out, and then they went back to the CMP examiner, sent an addendum to her, and asked her the same questions over and over again with an opinion. So that's when the first time I saw their own internal form. It showed on eBenefit, so I guess, what's this? And then I seen what it was. It had a place for an opinion on it.
Exactly. It says for internal VA use only, and then it has a section that says rationale and opinion, right? It has a big place that talks about prompting the doctor to provide rationale, whereas the other DVQ just says comments or something like that. So, it's kind of weights it in favor. The other thing, what you just mentioned, was the fact that a lot of the VA doctors do their DVQs online, so they have an online form, so they could type a couple books in there. There's no limitation on the space they use because it's just an online, whereas the paper ones are limited, you know, to the space that you have, sort of, unless you attach something to it, then it might get lost. It's weighted, the whole thing is kind of weighted in favor of the VA because it's not as fair to the outside doctor doing DVQs.
Yeah, they've got so many DBQs, it's a crapshoot, you know. I mean, the veterans, you know, they've got enough to do, and they go through, and the veterans just have to get a medical degree just to find out what's wrong with him.
And that's right. A lot of these, you know, a lot of veterans have complicated disease. That's part of the problem also with the PAs and nurse practitioners. They don't have much experience or younger, and oftentimes aren't as old as the disease process in the patient, for example, you know. They've never seen anything that extends that long over time. So they don't have a good chance to try and describe what the history is.
Yeah. That's why we get good doctors like yourself and a few other folks, you know, actually can navigate this system. You know, a lot of folks try to navigate it and they can't do it. So, you know, if you've been doing as long as you have, how many years have you been doing this now?
More than 20 for sure. So, but my first one probably in 86, maybe 30 years now. Time flies.
30 years.
So,
it does, don't it?
Yep. So, it's crazy. But the other thing is that there's a lot of these cases extend back over 30 years, you know. So the rules that applied 30 years ago still might apply under CUE and so on. And some of the rules that applied 5 years ago may still apply to cases that are pending. So it's nice to have that perspective on seeing the VA change over time, because then I know, you know, kind of how it's supposed to go. And then my thinking might be in line kind of with the DRO, because the older guys may have seen the same series of changes, you know.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, for example, the VA will tell you that if you file a claim that's so many years old, you know, your condition has to be meet what the regulations stated at the time that happened, not in the today's current world, but it happened, you know, back in 1986 or 85. That's what they look at. Have to use the regulations back in effect at that time, their current time period. So, you know, and they change. They change, right. You know, pretty much. They change a lot, you know. I mean, they'll try to reduce a lot of stuff, and they'll try to take severities away, and it's just a headache.
Yeah.
So
we talked a lot about, I think before, prior shows we talked about strain. The VA's gotten on this thing of strain a lot, where they, instead of giving people arthritis, they call it a strain, which maxes out like 10% instead of a higher percentage is for arthritis. So they're kind of using the schedule against the patient. Patients don't realize that they're rated for, you know, lumbar spine strain, but it's a limited rating because it's not a full-fledged arthritis.
So, well, strain's not really, I mean, it's just a strain. It's not, you know, I mean, unless you've got an MRI showing you got some disc problem and bone problem, that's not a strain. That's arthritis.
Right.
You know,
right. I think it's a whole different rating.
That's why. Yep. But they also have, in the back injuries, they've got two sets of criteria. They've got a verbal disc syndrome, and they've got traumatic arthritis. It's rated under two different programs.
Right.
Yeah. You've got to be able to separate those two out, too, and that makes it but makes it difficult.
Would scoliosis fall into that program of arthritis or rheumatoid arthritis?
Yeah, scoliosis is just a description of a little bit of a curve, you know, like S for scoliosis is kind of like an S curve is the way I think about it. But the a lot of people have a little bit of a leg length difference. Nobody has perfect leg length, and a little bit of leg length will cause a little bit of a spine twist, you know. So over time, I had a guy this week that came in and had scoliosis, and on the way in, I said that it was I said it was aggravated in service, and he came into service fit for duty, and then his back was aggravated in service, and it went to the DVA. The DVA judge says that was inconsistent. His sidekick judge. I said no, it wasn't inconsistent. Scoliosis is a sort of a normal phenomenon, but when he was in service, his back degenerated. It was aggravated over time, so that's totally consistent. You know, you can come in fit for duty with scoliosis. Almost everybody has some scoliosis. So the judge didn't really understand the medicine, and so that's why it was confusing. But so then scoliosis can be caused, you know, pathologic scoliosis can be caused by a lot of things, like you mentioned, arthritis, or maybe a vertebral body fracture, or maybe somebody had an amputation, or had leg length shortening, or something like that. So there's a lot of ways for it to occur. And then something of interest you guys might want to know about. This is very interesting that I saw this last week, that they're using large pieces of parachute cord with some screw bolts into the spinal vertebral bodies, and using the parachute cord on the convex side of the curve to straighten the curve out under kind of, you know, the elastic tension of a nylon cord or whatever, something like that. So that's a pretty interesting thing, because usually they always put rods in, these big rods, to try and straighten out scoliosis. And just a little less invasive, kind of a new thing.
That's bound to hurt.
Yeah, the rods are stiff, whereas this parachute cord like stuff is somewhat flexible, you know. That's a new little twist and turn. It's kind of interesting.
We'll call that the bungee cord procedure.
Cough, right? Yeah. Bungee cord, yeah. It looks like a bungee cord, big old thick cord, yeah.
Let me ask you, Gerald brought up a good point on scoliosis. I mean, scoliosis, a lot of veterans have scoliosis because a lot of veterans have other issues, you know. But, you know, for example, the spinal cord injury, we'll touch on this later, but people with paralyzed diaphragms, you know, like one side, say if it's the left side, your shoulder on your left side when your diaphragm is paralyzed always elevates. You can see, you know, you can see it on x-ray. That's how they use it, catch it, you know. And over a long period of time where that shoulder stays elevated, that's going to cause you to have scoliosis.
Yeah, anything that throws the body out of balance, you know, can whatever caused that muscle paralysis, the diaphragm is probably causing some paraspinal muscle problems or other type of strap muscle problems. Might be coming from your neck, for example. Yeah. So then that's going to that's going to cause the shoulder to modulate maybe in a compensatory fashion or whatever. Then that's going to change the weight and balance on your spine, and then, you know, it's going to start to aggravate everything. So, and then you might not use your shoulder right, and that shoulder might go bad because it's being overused. And the wrist might go bad on that side because the same kind of thing, you know,
What about atrophy in your shoulder if you have a situation? I mean, where it wastes away. Like, I've seen some folks, you know, their shoulders elevated like that, but it's half the size of the other shoulder, other side.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be wearing a shirt, and you know, on your sleeve will come down in your right spot about next to your elbow, and the left side it goes way down past your elbow.
Right. So the atrophy, you know, if you don't use something to atrophies, but also if you have nerve damage or muscle damage, you can atrophy on that basis too. So VA has a lot of questions in the DBQs about atrophy, and it's a sign you can see it, you got to try to figure out the cause of it. But in cases like that, a lot of times it's nerve damage that causes the atrophy because the muscle's not being used.
Not being used for.
Like the light switch is turned off. Light switch is turned off.
Yeah.
Yeah, not getting any juice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, it has a lot of effect on people. You know, it's been rough on me. You know, because it affects my entire left side. Still.
That's a huge problem. Also, you might get contractures from it. So, say, for example, you lose your muscle, like your triceps, which straightens your elbow out, then your elbow's like perpetually bent. And then when you have a perpetually bent joint, it can fuse or the biceps can get tight and you have contractures. You see that a lot in stroke patients or paralyzed patients have oftentimes contractures because they can't stretch for range of motion. So,
makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. But, again, I don't think the DBQ has enough, you know, in that situation. I've never actually seen one, you know, for certain, like, spinal cord and things like that. But I've seen, you know, just different, you know, it's got muscle skeletal issues with your back and bones and the disc and stuff. But it doesn't really cover that much on the neurological side. I haven't seen many of them. You probably have.
Yeah, no, they don't. The DBQ doesn't really cover it. Well, spinal cord, you want to get it, but spinal cord has, you know, some multifunction problems. So, you know, the DBQ is, like I say, mostly musculoskeletal range of motion and so on. But, you know, spinal cord has 10 million fibers going down there, and so there's a lot of functions that are going on. You know, so, for example, most of those things don't talk much about the neurogenic bowel and bladder part of it, which is huge. You know, the bladder can be like 60% by itself, and the bowel can be 100%. And those are huge, huge, huge problems with spinal cord. They could kill patients and cause infections and septicemia. And, you know, skin breakdowns because you can't feel. Oops, sorry, the DBQ doesn't talk any about the skin breakdowns. You know, decubiti, bye-bye decubiti. And then the DBQs aren't really talking about contractures. You know, from spinal cord, we just mentioned that. In fact, you can have knee, hip, ankle contractures, or you could have heterotopic ossification, new bone formation from little traumas or hemorrhages that you get like in your hip joints. You know, DBQs don't talk about any of that kind of stuff. And they don't really talk about, you know, erectile dysfunction either, which is something that happens in spinal cord a lot that patients have, you know, problems with. And then, you know, if you have catheterizations for your bladder, you might get urethral strictures, you might get urethral blind pouches. And same thing with the rectum. If you have to do digital stimulation, you might get fissures, or you might get some kind of little neuromas, or you might get prolapse of your rectum. And if you have complications of bladder, you might have to have surgery with a loop, and you might have to have a colostomy or some kind of a ostomy to drain your blood, suprapubic catheter. You know, none of those DVQs where we talk about any of that stuff. So, you know, you got to really know, you got to really know the medicine. So a patient like that comes in, I dig into it, because a spinal cord patient or a stroke patient or a multiple sclerosis patient, all those kind of have a similar final common pathway. We're going to have bowel, bladder, skin, and ED, and contractures and muscle, you know, blood clots, you know, blood clots in the lungs, your pulmonary embolus. It goes on and on, you know. The DVQ doesn't scratch the surface of any of that stuff. So it's fine, guys.
But you touched,
we had to read it.
Oh. You touched on strokes and things like that. You know, of course, if you have a stroke, there's a window there that they have to give you. Was it the TPA medicine they shoot you up with?
Yeah,
to try to reverse the effect of
the
stroke.
There's a lot of ins and outs of that. So stroke, you know, there's a couple types, main types. One's bleeding stroke and one's a non-bleeding stroke, you know. And so that TPA stuff, I was around when they first started using it, PW 20, 30 years ago. So there's a lot of protocols out there, like how much time you go before you give the TPA or how long you wait. And one thing, you don't want to give that anti-clotting stuff to somebody who's having a bleeding stroke. That's one of the big things, because you can make the bleeding worse. So usually they want to do like a CT scan to make sure there's not a lot of blood there. And then there's like a window. There's a window of time. And actually, I was at a conference this last winter, and they're talking about increasing the window maybe up to 18 hours or even a day later, a lot longer than what we used to think. I used to think like in the hour range. That might be in a day, you know, day range. So, and that's the whole justification for the rapid transit and the Maryland, you know, shock trauma kind of systems that are all over the country trying to get people in quickly. So that's one thing you can do, is you can put the TPA or something like that directly in the vein. That helps. Or you can put that stuff inside a catheter and squirt it right into the clot, if you know where the clot is, and if you find the clot on the MRI scan or angiogram. And then besides that, you can also put in, you can put these little like corkscrew things that go into your catheter. You can actually corkscrew in and pull the clot out that way if you find a big one. Or you can go in with a snare, like a little snare that you might use to catch a rabbit with or something, it's a little wire loop. You can take that, and sometimes you can wrap that around the clot and pull it out. So it's all about trying to get blood reperfused the brain. You know, my analogy is if the sprinkler head goes out in the grass, you're going to have a dead circle of grass, right? So the same thing in the brain. If you can fix that sprinkler head so that the water, the blood in this case, can perfuse the brain, then you're going to have a lot less problems with the stroke that we had before. And this stuff is evolving. You know, the type of medicine is evolving, how you give it, how long you give it, how fast you give it, how long you wait to get, all that stuff is changing like on a daily basis almost. It's crazy.
Yeah, technology's taken over a lot of different things too, you know, because I know back 20 years ago, I'd have a heart cath and go through your groin. Now they go through your wrist.
That's getting better. Years ago, I had a patient that was that had this big monster stroke. There's a lady yoga, lady yoga doctor. She was doing yoga in her residency. You know, new doctors don't have time for yoga. In the old days, there wasn't any yoga. Anyway, so she was doing yoga, but she got herself a blood clot right in her basal artery, which is the brainstem, you know, breathing centers. And I was there in the middle of the night reading the MRI scan. I saw this clot as clear as day on the MRI scan. I could see it. You know, I'd like to pick it out with my finger off the scan, but we didn't have any tools. It was like 25 years ago. We didn't have any tools to do it. Now I could put a corkscrew up there and take it out and probably save her life. She died. She basically died right there on the MR scan and film because we couldn't do anything about it. We diagnosed it. The time window was good. We just didn't have the tools to do anything else. So, yeah, you live long enough because you find out ways to cure stuff that we couldn't fix before, you know?
Yeah. So it seems like you've done some interventional radiography in your day.
Yep, I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah. It's all part of that neuroradiology training. You know, it's hard. I mean, I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't do it full time. I did my training, so it was good.
That's hard on you, though. I mean, you know, you've had a spinal cord injury yourself, so you know you've got you've lived for a long time with it, and that's you're just a. You know, you're
to do what you do. It's kind of an amazing feat.
Well, I like it. You know, I'm motivated to do it, so that's why I like to do it. Help, you know, my case took like 7 years of process, and you know, I've got nice training background, so I can help the veterans with their problems, and makes me feel good about what I'm doing, and you know, helping the next guy in line. And then also, you know, I do it independently. I get the testing. You know, I make sure that stuff's accurate, and the doctor follows me, is going to understand what I'm doing. But also at the same time, trying, you know, Hippocratic Oath and try and cure medicine. So I get testing for esophagus, make sure they have esophageal cancer. We get cardiac testing, and we do bladder testing and do bowel. You know, I do a lot of testing to make sure patients aren't falling through the cracks for their disease processes, because I get to look at the case for, you know, several hours, whereas the clinic doctor only gets 10 minutes. So that, you know, I can get a chance to do a whole body analysis and try and help them medically along with the VA rating schedule. That's the way it should work. You know, the veteran should be at an advantage because he's having these DVQs and these examinations, because he's getting a full body analysis and more testing, right? Helping live longer and be healthier. So that's the way the process should work if you have good doctors doing it and they have, you know, the ability to look around the whole body or test if they need.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's good. That is good. You know, veterans are living longer today. True as it is, you know, man, they've got these weight loss surgeries and things like that, and they're getting healthier, and that's a good deal.
Yeah, knocked out infections. Yeah, that's a good deal. Yeah. That's what you should look. Especially since a lot of stuff is brought up.
Like
what's that?
Yeah.
What's that? That's,
unless you go on the near-death diet like I did. I had a failed gastric sleeve and just about left the world.
Did you bleed or get infected?
No, I actually had a blowout. One of the staples blew out the stomach, and I had two more corrective surgeries. Yeah. Yeah, so I spent majority of in the last year in the hospital.
Digestive juices are eaten inside. Oh, man. How
they find ugly. That? I mean, I had... What happened was I had surgery, and I came home on day number 4. I started having stomach pain, and it got later on in the afternoon. It got really severe, so we went back to the emergency room, and they done a couple of tests, and they finally went and done a upper GI or whatever it is, you know, where you drink, and they saw it, and then they threw me and rushed me to the OR and got it cleaned out, and then about 2 weeks later they had another one, so it was. It was a fun time.
Another blowout. Did you have any fever infection with that or not? No.
Yes, I did. I did. I had. I had fever infection. I was septic. I had all kind of fun stuff. But Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, the reason you got septic, audience, is because it leaks bowel contents. So there's a lot of sort of not sterile stuff that's leaking out of there.
It's ugly. It's really ugly. But I did run across a very good infectious disease doc. It really helped me.
Yeah.
And, he was really good at what he did. And I think he's the one that kind of saved my life. You know, the surgeon was pretty good, too. But, so it was a rough time.
Well,
it was 125 pounds ago.
Oh, man. Well, that's always a joke in medicine. You just keep getting sicker and sicker. Eventually, you're going to see an infectious disease doctor, you know, because that's really complicated. So, those ID doctors, they do 3 years of maternal medicine, and then they do like 3 years of infectious disease. So they've got a nice long period of time of training. They can save your life. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do. They're good doctors. I tell you, it's a good thing I ran into this guy. So.
Yeah.
But.
Medicine. Dr. Medicine's a team. You like the radiologist? Yeah. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? When do you recommend a veteran to get an IMO? What stage of his claim do you recommend?
Well, I like it. Yeah, I like it. I like it before the. Well, maybe right off the bat. Needing service. I do these cases now. Patients in service. You know, it's really nice because I get. You know, because they have that benefit before discharge now, so they're having the VA doctor see them while they're in service. So. You know, if they have a medical discharge, that board sometimes is biased against the veteran. And if the VA doctor is biased against them, you know, then by the time they're exited from service, and they go to the VA, they've got two negative reports on the record already. So what I try to do is try and get my IMO, IME testing done while they're in service. And when they're in service, all that testing is for free, and we can get it all done. You know, 6 months before the exit, I can get all this stuff done. When the VA doctor rolls in, he already sees my IMO or my IME, and he's got to either disagree with me or agree with me. And if he disagrees with me, then he's not being truthful. He's going to get himself in trouble for, you know, malpractice thing or something like that. So normally if I do my work and it's well documented and rationale, then they'll agree with me. And then a lot of times if they agree with me, then the medical board also can make that a little bit more straightforward. So then by the time you get to the VA for the rating, the medical board lines up with the VA doctor's evaluation, lines up my evaluation, and your rating goes through. I've had patients, I've got them 100% right out of service during that kind of process. So if you're out of service, then you have, you know, it's nice to have an IMO or IME. When I do my IMOs and IMEs, I actually will critique to the doctor, say, Dr. Smith said this. I agree with Dr. Smith on these 3 points, and I disagree on these other 3 points, whatever. You know, so I kind of referee the medical opinions, which most doctors don't do. But I know that if I don't do that, then there's no way that the rater, who's a non-doctor, has any idea to figure out who Dr. A is or who Dr. B is and which one, who agrees with who and who doesn't. Just the rater's confused by the whole thing. So I kind of help. It's actually helping the rater referee it. So then, you know, anytime there's a decision, especially now under the new schedule, if we have, you know, the new rating process, if we have a decision that's negative, you want to put in a supplemental claim, you have to have new evidence. And so on that new evidence, you can use an IMO, an IME, more testing, you know, so that way you get a better chance of getting a better rating because you have really concrete new evidence coming in. And then, you know, the board, the BVA will take new evidence too, so with the BVA, we can get evidence in. So I think any next level step, you should get IMO, IME, and also any place you have a decision, any major decision, you should think about an IMO, IME. I know it's, I mean, I can't even do all those IMEs and IMOs I'm talking about for all the veterans, but I'm just saying that to be a professional workup, you should really have, you know, a professional write-up to make sure that all the different aspects are considered.
About how many IMOs and IMEs have you done, Doctor?
Well, I've done, it depends how you count this stuff, right? So 20 years, I've done about 5,000 patients, you know. So if each patient, they said the average patient has seven issues, so I've probably done like 40,000 issues, something like that.
Oh,
so
that's a lot.
I did a lot of them. Yeah, I did a lot of them. Yeah, I just knock them out. I did a lot of them. That's probably didn't count the ones. I was with the paralyzed veterans. I was doing those site visits. Every 2 weeks, I was going on site to the big hospitals, and I was seeing, you know, we had like 20 inpatients, and I was doing lots of exams and a lot of stuff that was not. You know, so what we did is I'd evaluate the patients and read the x-rays and the bedside and talk to the nurses, then we debrief with the director. So I was covered a lot of issues with the director just verbally and written reports that weren't really – back in that day, they weren't really IMOs, IMEs. They're more like issues in the hospital that were wrong that you could use to help the director understand why you need to put resources someplace. You know, this guy lost his leg because the nursing care is not good or something like that. So I've got a lot of experience. You know, I've been in these VA hospitals. I know what the pressures the doctors are under. I trained in the VA hospital for 3 years. I talked to all these directors. We debriefed with the chief of medicine and chief of spinal cord and the director, you know, secretary of the VA back in the day. So, you know, I understand the culture and I understand the forces that the hospitals are under and I understand the doctor, you know, budget. I understand all that stuff, but I don't use that as an excuse not to provide good care to the patients, and I don't use the excuse to make sure the patients get the testing they need for their DBQs and for their rating, you know.
You still travel a lot, Dr. Bash?
I travel some, you know. I travel some. It travels hard on me. And it slows me down because I can't, you know, my files are displaced in places. And then, you know, I can't work as efficiently. But,
You know, I could be talking to traveling places, you know. I'm not, nothing's broken. My wrists and shoulders all work. I can get myself around. So,
yeah,
but I'm getting older, so it's getting harder. But, you know, still move.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if I have
used
a couple of years.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in California right now, for, you know, summertime. But it's nice if a couple of patients, you know, I've told people if they gather 3 or 4 patients or so I can go someplace and see them all at the same time. Or sometimes I'll have a,
yeah,
you know, a patient wants to pay me to travel in to be an expert witness at a BVA hearing or a DRO hearing or something like that. I guess they might get rid of the DRO hearings now with this new process. I don't know if they're doing hearings, but anyway, I've traveled in there to be an expert witness. And, you know, do an exam, expert witness.
You probably have a lot more success at the BVA level, don't you, versus the DROs?
I don't know. The BVA knows me just from a social networking standpoint. The BVA, a lot of those judges know my work over 20 years, you know. And a lot of them, I've been there talking to them directly face-to-face over many years. So they know that I'm a straight shooter and that I try and do the best job I can. And a lot of them welcome me because they realize I read the file. They realize I have the facts straight. You know, what do you think, Dr. Bash? I'll tell them what I think. I'm almost like an advisor to them, you know. But at the regional office level, it's more complicated because there's a lot more offices. There's 65 offices or something, and I don't know how many DROs there are, but there's several hundred of them out there. So the DROs don't necessarily know me personally as well as the BVA judges do, so that has an impact. But, you know, those DROs are really like little judges. I mean, they think the same way. They know the law. They know, you know, their experience. A lot of those DROs are more experienced than a lot of those new BVA judges now, you know, because they're new on the block. And the DROs know the history of the VA and how it's evolved over time and what the rating schedule's done. So, I think it's more about the person than it is necessarily the place that I'm at.
Yeah, it's true. Makes a lot of sense. It does. That is true. It's more about the person than anything else because, you know, if they understand the working relationship you have with them, you know, it's a trust factor and things like that, too. That's good.
Yeah. The DRO has... Your DRO has a lot of liberty to decide whatever they want, you know. Like I did a case, I was in Baltimore, I got a sever guy, and I sit there. The DRO walks in, he has kidney disease, you know, 100%, on dialysis, and they're going to sever him. The DRO goes, you just wrote this letter, right? You're a doctor, right? He says, yeah. I said, yep. He says, wait a second. Walks out of the room for a couple minutes, comes back, and has the patient sign the form, says, I'm not going to sever him, I'm not even going to turn the recorder on, get out of here. You know, so those DROs can do, they have a lot of power, you know. They can decide what they want, which is like little judges, so that's good. But,
good.
I don't know, like I said, I have the DROs. Are the DROs going to stay around with this new process they have? I guess
probably.
They're the upper level review, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say that. It'll be that second
level review. It is an effective measure that they use with the DROs. I mean, personally, I think it's.
Yeah, I like them.
You know, if I've got a claim, I'm going to the BVA, I'm not going to mess around with the DRO.
Yeah.
So it just you know, it just costs a lot of time. I mean, how many DROs you been to, Gerald?
Oh, I don't know, several. About 3, maybe 4.
Yeah.
And so far, it's all been for naught. I don't care what you show them; they got a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
Same DRO, Gerald.
Different.
Go ahead, Dr. Bash.
Oh, yeah, is it the same DRO or is it different DROs?
Yeah, these are different ones that I met with.
Yeah.
But I can, even with your IMO, I had problems with them. And then I had problems with Dr. Bartels. See, he's a... Agent Orange specialist, and he's got, I think he's got 2 clinics now, one down in Texas and then one back east there somewhere. But they had problems. It didn't matter what I showed them, you know.
Yours is toxicity, right? Toxicity
yes.
Issue. And the VA just notoriously wants to not talk about toxicity because they don't want to open the pipeline for millions of veterans. You know, so they really, we win them, but, you know, my IMO is probably still cooking for you, but, you know, it's a hard issue for the VA to want to grant those.
Well, yes, it is, but they have owned up to the use of BX, BX modified, mustard agent, herbicides,
right,
and radiation, and I think there's a couple more in there. So now they admitted that. I just say,
this
well,
mustard,
we
right? We thought yours was mustard, right? We thought mustard or something. What was
yes,
yours?
Yes, mustard agent.
Yeah, right.
I think that's what they got
admitted,
my
they admitted you're exposed to it, but now they don't want to, admit to the nexus, right?
Yeah.
And I probably wrote a strong, I don't remember, but I probably wrote a strong letter about the nexus, so as
you
do.
Yes.
Yeah, another one to split hairs. Another one to split hairs is full body exposure.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, try to see it wasn't exposed low dose, right? Something like that.
Well, if you were in field testing, that's classified as full body exposure, so they couldn't really get away from that. But it's still they've kept it in the appeal stage, so
I
can't get them to render a decision. They keep remanding. And,
you probably got a big retroactive award, right, Gerald?
It's
a big retroactive award. Yeah.
If I live
that's
long enough, yeah.
Right. That's why they're trying to delay it. Right.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So it's going to add up to quite some money right now.
Yeah.
I kind of pictured is that...
Oh, go ahead.
I kind of picture it as a Tremors movie with a guy who's got all explosives on his truck in that warehouse and all them monsters in there trying to eat that MREs out of his truck. He sets that truck off. And he runs by the building and tells everybody to run. This is going to be big. And they stop about 100 feet. And he said, no, it's going to be bigger than that. They take off.
They go 300 feet.
Yeah, no.
But my analogy,
I don't know.
The pole vault. You know, the first 1 foot of the pole vault is easy. The last 20 feet is really almost impossible. You know.
Yeah.
Like the VA, first 10% is easy, and 90%, 100% is possible.
Yeah, and they give you that. They give you that 60-foot stick. They use this. That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
You got to stick that stick in the hole.
Well, that just don't,
in order to do it.
Yeah, they don't understand because they say, oh man, the first 10% was so easy, you know. Then how come this last 10% was so hard? You know, it's that 60-foot pole, right?
Yeah, it's a 60-foot pole in VA math.
Yeah.
And if you get 90% in order to get 100, you got to get more than 10% because they don't, the 10 after 90 is only 1%.
Exactly. Yeah, 50%. Says where you are, you might be 88 too, 87.
Yeah.
It's a long way to get there,
yeah. So at least you have to have 10 tens at 90% to even get 100, or 11 tens, I mean.
Yeah.
Because it's... I don't know who came up with this math, but it's not your mother's math. I didn't learn this in school either.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they got a good bonus.
Yep. Disappearing math.
Yeah.
Dr. Bash, are you sort of snickering yourself?
Well, yeah, yeah.
You are, aren't you?
Spinal cord. I got hurt.
Mm.
Yep. Spinal cord. Like I said, my case took 7 years. You know, because I got hurt sports, and then I think the problem with me was that I was young, right? So I was like 27 years old, so they didn't want any part of giving me a big, you know, give me a spinal cord award because I'd be living my 33. They saw me living 33 years, you know. So they didn't want any part of granting that. Number one, number two, I got hurt in med school, and then I went to the rehab, and then I popped out and started back in med school in my wheelchair. So they're like thinking, well, this guy's fit. Well, I wasn't very fit, but I was tenacious, you know. And so that was that also hurt me a little bit. But, you know, I got through it. My doc had to write like 5 letters, you know. And, oh, my God. I had to go down to the BVA and talk to the – I was down there. Back in the day, the BVA building was open to the public, right? So I went down there Friday afternoon, and one of the Raiders, one of the, I don't know, he must have been a, I don't know what his role was. He must have been like a, one of the decision team members, you know? He was like, who are you? I said, oh, Doc, he goes, you're a doctor in a wheelchair. He goes, you didn't just fall off an apple truck. I said, no, I'm hurt. My case is here somewhere. So he pulled it off the shelf and decided in a couple weeks. It'd probably still be on the shelf. I would go down there, you know. It's crazy.
Well, did they give you a hard time? Were you a medical doctor? Did they listen? You know, did they give you a hard time over your own opinions and stuff? Because I know they got slapped for doing that once to a doctor.
Oh, I mean, with me as far as me, my opinions.
Dr. Pons.
Sure.
Yeah, Dr. Pons. He was a chiropractor, and he got a Jeep wreck overseas, and. They kept discounting his opinion, even though he's a medical doctor. And he finally won his claim.
Oh, yeah. I didn't write anything for my own claim because it would be like bias, you know. Although the VA actually can allow that because your expertise. But I had my own doctor. I had my own doctor write letters for me, you know. So I took 5 of his letters. But the VA over the years is. Said derogatory things about me, you know, at the BVA level and the you know, the admin side and chief of benefits. And so I think I have 3 or 4 letters of apology from these high level, you know, board of written appeals. So, you know, so now that was my first start. They were really kind of had an abuse response. So now they kind of, if they recognize me as an expert and, you know, don't try to degrade me based on a personal attack. We just talk about the facts of the record, you know, and the data, the medical data, and the medical opinions and the rationale. So it's more peaceful now than it was when I first started.
That's good. That is good. Question about what are the grade of a spinal cord injury as far as, you know, complete, incomplete, things like that?
Yeah, so those are interesting terms. Like, you know, when you think about complete, you might think about the cord being cut all the way across, right? But there's, it's not really like that. The cord is called a cord because it's really strong. It's 10,000 fibers, like I said, go down through there. So the guy in Australia has like 12, like about almost 2,000 spinal cords. And out of all those cords, only a couple of them actually are really what's called transected, you know? So most of the cords are still intact at some level, and it's the same thing with the brain. The faster you get it treated, decompressed, the more fibers you can save, and it functions better. So once you have some function, then, you know, complete. Sometimes if you have a bad stroke or blood clot or infection, sometimes you can cut off the blood supply of the cord, and the cord will die, and then you'll have what's called a complete injury, which means there's not much function. There's some accessory pathways, but not much function below the cord. And then the incompletes are the other category. You have some residual function below. And so that's part of it. That's kind of a general term. And then we're getting better and better with imaging. We're going to be able to use imaging and grade these things in a more sophisticated way based on, you know, area volume and signal changes. And that's going to make a difference in how we treat it. But then, so once you have this incomplete thing, then you have to go through the testing. That's where the DVQ concepts come in. Really on DVQ, but you do muscle strength testing and sensory testing and range of motion, and then you do vibration and position, maybe hot, cold, and get an idea of what's going on in the different extremities, and you get that radiculopathy and myelopathy, so you can get rated for some percent for your cord, and you also get rated for some percent for your radiculopathy for each extremity, and you get rated for the bowel, bladder, loss of function, stuff like that. It all gets into that special monthly compensation schedule, right? So you can't use your legs.
Yeah.
makes a lot of issues.
Right.
Okay, so I mean,
yeah.
But your spinal, I mean, it could affect it a lot, every system in your body, every muscle too, couldn't it?
Yep. Yeah, it affects the immune system. It affects the bowel. You know, it affects your bones, osteoporosis, skin. Really, it's really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to get out of control blood pressure, high and low. It's not just reflexive stuff. You can die from that. You can die from hypo or hyperthermia. You can die from blood loss because you can't compensate for your blood loss. You know, and then complicating that, a lot of times you're throwing these meds at the patients. You're throwing these pain pills at the patients so their brains are obtunded and they, you know, they fall asleep on a heater and burn themselves, or they'll get too cold and freeze to death, or, you know, they'll get infected and not feel it, not understand why their blood pressure is going through the ceiling. And, you know, poor spinal cord guys, all those guys and all the neurologic guys, if their brain's not working well, then they can't protect themselves. Multiple sclerosis, all those guys are, you know, in big trouble.
Yeah.
Car wreckers, can't drive. Get went over in a wheelchair.
You still drive?
I'm still driving. I still drive. I'm starting to get away from that too. My family doesn't want to ride with me. I don't want to ride with you. You're not driving that well. I go across town. It takes 5 minutes this direction, and I'll take all right-hand turns. It takes me 10 minutes because I don't want to go make left-hand turns. You know, left-hand turns are dangerous. You go across the highway, or I'll take a road that doesn't have any speed bumps on because I don't want to rattle my spine around. Speed, you know, it's crazy.
Well, that's really, you know, that's good. At least you got hand controls in your car.
Well, yeah, and also, I
know. So, you know Charles Krause, remember, don't you?
Yeah. I'm a friend of a friend. Poor Charles.
Yeah,
so Charles.
Yeah.
Charles died of you know, they think the newspaper said something about stomach cancer, maybe, or some kind of bowel cancer. So I looked up. You know, if you look up spinal cord cancer, I was thinking, well, I know about bladder cancer, but almost all cancers in spinal cord are 5, 3, 4, 5, 10 times increased. What's that about, right? So that's the way we're going to die. Spinal cord or infection or skin breakdown or cardiac disease, you know, we're also going to die of cancer. Probably medication.
Yeah, it's kind of weird,
isn't it?
They thought they got his, but they didn't get it all, I'm guessing it.
Yeah, well,
pretty sad.
The problem with spinal cord is you don't have. Yeah, he's a good asset, good nice guy, but the problem with the, spinal cord, you don't feel it, so you might not have much sensation with that cancer for a long time before it actually became a problem. The other thing that happens to spinal cord, that happens with me too, is that, you know, we all have chronic pain, right? So maybe our chronic pain might be some number of units. Some number of units, say they're 900 units out of a maximum 1,000, 800 units, some number, big number. That's your baseline pain. So then say you get a little toothache, and you go, a toothache's like a 5, a 10, 20, some number small, right? But in comparison to your spinal cord pain, it's like nothing. So you just like ignore it. I'm not going to pay attention. It's nothing. Whereas if I was a normal person, the toothache pain would be my number one thing to take me to the hospital, whereas spinal cord guy doesn't even care because it's like in the grass, right? It's mediocre. Right. So Krauthammer might be like that. He might have a little belly pain that he didn't really pay attention or think was much of anything, you know? And maybe I'm just speculating, but I know from my own experience I've done stuff like that where things can be seriously painful problem for the normal person, would I just ignore it.
Yeah, you won't basically even know it, really. Yeah, it's masked.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like
a lot of diabetics. Stereo. Yeah, exactly.
It's like
stereo's
a lot of diabetics having, I know a lot of diabetics had heart attacks and passed away, and they didn't know it.
Yeah, because they've got, like, neuropathy, right? You got extremity pain, and heart attack was nothing in comparison. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's all relative.
Okay.
The relative pain is small compared to what you know.
Well, Dr. Bash, our hour is about up, buddy. I wanted to thank you for coming on. We need to do this again in a couple of weeks until we get all these bash goals covered.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll knock them off one by one.
Come back and join us.
Yep. Yeah, we'll knock them off one by one. Just take them out.
Okay. You want to give your
all right.
Give us your contact information
Location. Yeah, location. Yep. So once again, I always tell people to Google Craig Bash on Google. If that's the easy way to find me, get my website. But besides that, then you can go Dr. Bash, like Delta Romeo Bash, last name, and then at @DOCTOR, so it's at doctor.com. And then, you know, my cell is text is 240-506-1556, 240-506-1556. But a good way to get me is call Skip. Skip's my scheduler guy. Skip is 925-381-7561, 925-381-7561. Okay. Yep.
All right.
Call Skip, schedule a half-hour free consultation.
Skip, is that your ain't that your computer guy?
Skip's my schedule. Skip does my scheduling stuff for me, you know? He's fielding my emails and my phone calls and then sets up a call schedule. So I just told patients how to get a hold of me. But would you just call Skip? Skip can get me a half-hour phone conversation the next day or the same day. He just calls me up and sets it up. So that's the way to do it.
No problem. No, Craig.
Yeah,
we appreciate Dr. Bash. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Bash. We really appreciate it.
All right. Yep. You're welcome.
Right.
See you guys later.
Gerald, thanks for coming on, buddy, and being our co-host today. I haven't done this show very often, but I think I want to do some more here pretty soon. But with that.
Well, I'm glad to be able to. And thank you, Dr. Bash, for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks, boys.
Yep.
See you later.
Yep. With that, this is BJ Master, Mr. Gerald Cook, and Dr. Bash. We'll be signing off for now.
You have been listening to The Basser Hour. The Basser Hour is brought to you by Haddit.com. Stay tuned next week for another edition of The Basser Hour and the Haddit.com Blog Talk Radio Show. Thanks for listening.
Have a good